to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Hello, hello, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com. And this is a pre-recorded interview for March 1st, 2016. Now, as you all know, I have been talking about guardians for a very long time. I've had my own personal experiences regarding the guardians back all the way to 2002, 2003, somewhere around that time frame. And I have been planning for a very long time to create a series of interviews regarding the perspectives that I've developed from my own training, my own path, my own journey, etc. And I couldn't think of a better person to pull on to this interview today than Adam Apollo. And Adam, as many of you know, has launched the Guardian Alliance Academy. Okay. We're going to go ahead and give you a lot of information. I think this interview is going to be just jam-packed. So kick back and get a drink and relax. I think you're going to be going for a ride of your life. Adam has offered many insights on consciousness development and physics, future technology, planetary transitions at the White House, in a United Nations summit, and at conferences and festivals around the world. He awoke to a complete library of sacred geometry and metaphysical knowledge at the age of 15. He has spent many years afterwards teaching and integrating this information through developing deep personal magical and martial arts practices. And you're going to get a flavor of that when you investigate some of the courses that are being offered within Guardian Alliance Academy. Adam has also helped to organize two prayer runs. He's been involved with the White Buffalo Calf Woman. He also was involved in science projects all the way back from high school regarding loop quantum gravity, string theory, quantum mechanics, and relativity. You sound very, very intelligent, Adam.
Well, it's great that I sound that way. Hopefully I feel that way as well.
Wow. Anyway, he's also been involved in research with astrophysics, philosophy, cultural anthropology, and psychology. And the most important thing in my heart and soul is he has been leading advanced workshops and self-development of Jedi training. Now, hopefully that's clicking within each of your hearts and souls, all you guardians out there that you know I've been trying to gather together for a while. We're still working on it.
Thank you.
So Adam has really done an incredible job in putting this together. And it's clear to both of us that I think we're going to be doing some work together ourselves in the future, since we're both so focused on the Guardians and the Guardian Alliance of this planet, as well as the cosmos. Now, Adam, I checked out the Academy. I was absolutely blown away with the verbiage, because there's some overlapping within Galactic Connections verbiage on my landing page. And I clearly knew this was divinely guided. And just for everyone's knowledge out there, BB Tinsley, my assistant, really pushed me to do this. I'm sure there's some people out there getting a chuckle on that one. Anyway, I love, there are core things within the Academy that you're focusing on, accessing your potential, activating your gifts, awakening your awareness. These are all language that I use with my alchemy, and also when I'm working through the verbiage within my site. Tell me a little bit about, where did all of this information come from? Did this happen when you were 15?
Well, when I was 15, the door kind of opened up for me. Becoming aware of my human energy field, of my chi, and realizing that my body is fundamentally interconnected with the rest of the universe was kind of the tip of the iceberg. At that point, I began to get downloads every single day. And I'd be sitting in school, high school, and, you know, sleeping through first period, and then suddenly have a flash of a dragon rolling into a sphere with all four elements weaving around it, fire, air, earth, and water, forging this crystalline sphere of spirit that then ignites like a sun. And I would just sit up and look out the window and then grab my sketchbook and then start drawing it, you know, and start tracing it. And I would go after school and smoke some pot with my friends and sit and go into meditative states in which I began to very tangibly feel and understand the divisions between the elementals, the structures of how they weave together. And over time, opened up layer after layer of my energy body, not knowing anything about chakras, not knowing anything about dimensionality of fields. I was sort of discovering the nature of consciousness from first principles through experiencing the witnessing of patterns in the trees and nature, through watching leaves and how they fall, how they ride the wind, watching water in rivers move around stones and create vortices, watching fire, and witnessing these fundamental repeating patterns occurring throughout nature that give rise to all that we experience here and now. And so, to say where the Guardian Alliance emerged from, you know, I could speak to my own experience of discovery of consciousness. But over time, I began to realize that most of the things that I was downloading, I had a framework for them because I had put some sort of library away for a very, very long time. And the more I began to open the books of the library, the more I realized that I'd written this library for myself, and that I'd given myself very, very specific triggers that I could use to access these same energy ley lines. And then, of course, the universe around me and the spirit of all that is would confirm those experiences for me, that would give me confirmation after confirmation after confirmation after confirmation, with just absolutely crazy things happening for a high school kid's mind. But I knew that this information was something that I had known for ages somehow. This was before I had any past life experiences. I didn't even know what that was. I had some concept of reincarnation, but I wasn't sure whether or not that was true. But once I began to really have past life memories, it all made sense. I immediately saw and remembered moments with people and other times in which that information saved my life, it saved their lives, it saved lives of my tribe. It enabled me to do things that sometimes were amazing and sometimes were karmic hell for me for lifetimes after.
I think we can all relate to that, Adam.
Yeah. You know, we all, I think, or many of us who have deeply magical backgrounds have some experience with the use of magic for the well-being of all, and also the abuse of magic and
absolutely
how hard, you know, you can fall when that happens.
Yeah, definitely. So,
and I've traversed both sides and forgive and love myself completely, you know, for everything that I've been through.
Well, and right on, right on. And that's where we all need to be, definitely. I think so much of the scarring and the wounding of many of the guardians that have come forth is because they have not forgiven themselves.
Yeah.
For those things that they felt that they were literally forced into. Meaning the battles, et cetera, and the traumatic experiences that they withstood. So you have talked very openly about a fairly traumatic experience when you were younger and your father's wife, correct? Mm-hmm. Lost her life in a car accident?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. How did that impact the movement of moving forward with the Guardian Alliance and, you know, how did that kind of change the way you saw, the way you were moving, where you were going? I would imagine it was pretty intense.
Yes. Well, that was for me around the time that I was about 11. And I may have been 10 actually till that year.
Wow.
And at the time, I had just been in India with my mom for the first time. My family on my mother's side has a strong connection in India because my grandparents knew a gentleman named Mehrwan Sherrier Irani, which many people refer to as Meher Baba. Mm-hmm. And he was a teacher and a healer who traveled around the world. And basically, you know, countless experiences of him record events like him literally wiping leprosy off of people all over India, and having experiences like some of my grandparents' friends described where they went to see him for the first time around the time of Woodstock. And the moment that they looked in his eyes and he met their eyes, they had a full God realization experience, just complete blast into yes. source of all that is. And most people that encountered him believe that he was an avatar of this age. And his whole teaching was that the divine is in everyone, that every path is the same, and that no matter where you go or what you do, you're always going to fulfill your divine destiny. And also that he took this vow of silence and said that when he would break his silence, he would break it inside of everyone. In other words, there was this passing of this Piscean torch to a much more Aquarian concept that he was bringing, which is that really the silence of the infinite eternal is only really broken through our own realizations inside of us. So anyway, I didn't know much about him at that time. My mother took me to India. We went to Mehrabad and these different places where people come from all over the world in pilgrimages to experience this place. And I had some very, very potent experiences there, but ones that I didn't have any framework for as an 11-year-old kid. And then on my way back from that trip to India, I traveled for about 36 hours by train and bus and then planes. Oh, and I didn't sleep for almost the entire journey. I just couldn't sleep. I was just awake and alive, and I wanted to watch movies, and I wanted to just interact with people. And I finally passed out on the last flight from Atlanta, Georgia, up to Illinois, and or near St. Louis, where my dad lived at the time. And I passed out so hard that when the plane landed, the stewardess came down the aisles and literally had to shake me awake. And everybody was already off the plane.
Oh my God.
And they were cleaning the plane. And so she brings me off the plane and I'm in a dream world. Wow. You know, I feel like I'm in a whole nother world, and it's weird and kind of spooky. And I get off the plane, and she walks me up to my dad. She's like, "This your father?" And I said, "Yes." And he's looking at me, and I know that something is wrong, majorly wrong. And his eyes are all bloodshot, and he waits, he gets the stewardess to go away. And he says, "You know, your stepmother just died in a car accident along with your stepbrother's fiance. And your stepbrother was driving the car, and he's in the hospital, and he has critical injuries. Do you want to go home now and rest, or do you want to go drive 2.5 hours to Peoria and see your brother?"
Wow.
And I said, "I want to see my brother."
Yeah.
And I went, and, you know, that was the beginning of a very interesting period for me. This was basically fifth grade, and I was going into fall semester of fifth grade, and I decided to stay with my dad and my stepbrother for that semester and take care of them. I'd been going to school at my mom's in New Mexico, and in staying with my dad, I didn't sleep hardly at all for like that entire 6 month period. I would sleep for a couple hours a night, you know, go to school. I didn't care about friends. I didn't care about, anything. Like, I was like in this numb reset state trying to figure out what the heck was going on with my reality.
Yeah, big time. You were assimilating all that you had received from the I'm not going to call him a guru.
Yeah. Meher Baba, yeah. I mean, it was a deep, deep gift that little spiritual wave had happened in conjunction with this, because it began to reveal to me things about my stepmother, whose name was Carolyn, who passed, that I didn't really understand either. She was a very powerful psychic. She my father married her because she was like the most incredible woman he'd ever met. She would like go buy all the blankets at Goodwill and then spend all day long walking around barefoot under highways, passing out blankets to homeless people.
Oh,
and teaching people about divine love, and telling, she just constantly was talking about divine love, divine love, divine love. And when she was gone, I suddenly started really reflecting on the things that she talked about. And I started really kind of, for the years after that, until I was 15, I started really questioning everything. I started really reflecting on these powerful experiences that I'd had with her and in India. And I think all of that journey, and really that very crushing, very difficult time period for me, was a seed that helped me to actually wake up. And it took me long enough, that's for sure. It definitely took me a while, because I have a very logical, very precise, scientific mind. You have to prove to me that something is true. And it took the concert of the universe to prove to me the beauty of the divine and all that is. So I'm very thankful.
Oh, that's fantastic, though. And, you know, you're just such an old soul. I mean, you're what, 33?
I'm 33.
Oh my gosh, which is such a magical age anyway. You know, it's a great time to be alive. Anyway, well, the other thing was I fell in love with just your calling through the words that you used. And I love this. I just have to read this to everyone. It says, "Mastery is achieved when one understands that all things, all ways, all cultures, and all paths hold innate wisdom for that which is in is our own way, our own personal path. It's exactly what you're talking about. A master swordsman may relate every nuance of life to the way the forge burns, the sword is tempered, the metal hardens, and the blade flows. A master fisherman sees the lessons of the sea in the waves of emotion, the storms of life's changes, and the trust of a sturdy sail and a steady wind. And a master carpenter secures each structure in life, choosing materials wisely and anchoring an architecture. So how would you define the architecture that you're anchoring?
Well, I'm building an alliance of people dedicated to a planet that is healthy, sovereign, full of individuals who have the capacity and freedom to make their own choices and build their own communities and choose what is right for themselves, and a family that is ready to go beyond this planet and meet our other amazing communities out there among the stars and actually help to care for this planet, not just leave it, but to care for it as stewards, as guardians, and protect this beautiful gift that we've been given for generations to come.
I love it. Now, you know, Adam and I had talked off air about the Guardian Alliance. Many people out there are very familiar with Anna Hayes, which is also known as Ashiana Dean, and also Lisa Renee. Those are about the only two people I know that have even discussed the Guardians in any kind of depth. And I wanted to ask you, you know, the definition of the Guardian Alliance upstairs, okay, is it's supposedly a smaller specialized group, primary task force, within a greater guardian organization called the Interdimensional Association of Free Worlds. Mm-hmm. It's created 568 million years ago after the Angelic Wars. And it says the Guardian Alliance is a cooperative organization through which an enormous variety of different interstellar, multidimensional, and inter-time species and races work together to assist in the evolution of developing cultures throughout the multidimensional universe. You said to me you had no idea this was even existing when this came through.
Yeah, that's right. I actually, that's the paragraph that I read when I looked up Guardian Alliance to see if there was anything on Google about it, because when the name landed, it landed. And I had just been holding this Council of Jedi down in Ojai at this very, very special place around this big table. We had ambassadors from all over who are working on films, working on big projects. My partner that I co-founded Unify with was there. Akira Chan, who does has done a lot of amazing films about transformational festival culture and things like that. Alexander Fairman, who you'll see in the Guardian Alliance. Yeah. David Beaudry, who is also in the Guardian Alliance and a teacher there. And we spent literally days hashing out how we were going to take all of our diverse threads and somehow weave them together to create, some vehicle for us to onboard the masses to the truth of who they are and how we're going to actually make this sustainable transition happen. And I left that council with the Guardian Alliance ringing in my consciousness. And I was literally driving in the car and decided to look it up on my phone as I'm driving. And the first thing that comes up is a link to the Kelantic Dictionary. And I like literally am reading that while I'm driving going, oh my God, somebody knows about us.
What a confirmation, huh?
Yeah. Well, and I always laugh about, as a side note, I always laugh about things like, you know, 568 million years ago. I'm like, how do they know it was 568? Like, I'm just not that good with like exact, you know, numbers when it comes to galactic time, because, you know, the Earth time and galactic time is different.
There's Earth and what is time? Yeah. How do we define time? Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, they list a lot of the core grail races and things like that. And maybe before we dive in, tell everyone a little bit about where you have attained your knowledge through your transpersonal psychology, you know, journeys. Maybe let's do that first and then go into this.
Yeah. A little bit of groundwork around lifetimes of knowledge is useful. It's very useful. So as I said before, you know, I've always been somebody who has a lot of difficulty just accepting something as true. Like, I have to challenge it and dig and dig and dig. And this made me very, you know, a good researcher in school. And I did extremely well in school. I was valedictorian in my high school my freshman year. And then I woke up, and after I woke up, I was like, wow, high school sucks. And then I spent most of my time exploring metaphysics and consciousness and studying ancient cultures and studying physics as well. And, you know, after I had this big journey of kind of assembling my unified harmonic matrix, the physical theory of the universe, and a lot of my unified field theory, which I developed at that time, I then began to have all of these different past life experiences. And at this time, as it really got going, I was in college and I was taking psychology. I was studying philosophy, cultural anthropology at the time. And I began to see that I had to apply some kind of, you know, method to this, because, you know, it's one thing to just have a memory, right? And, you know, you go back in this lifetime and you say, all right, when you were five and you were on the playground and you were playing Foursquare, you know, describe to me exactly what happened, you know, on this day. And you think back and you remember bits of it, right? And you get bits and pieces. You remember like really embarrassing moments, right? You remember really exciting moments, like a kiss, you know, or whatever, you know. And yet the way that you remember those moments usually doesn't actually have the whole picture of what was going on. Like, we put our own filter on it. We interpret it our own way because of where we were at. You know, the guy that kicked us, it was like, that guy was such a mean person, blah, 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 blah. But maybe we forget that we were like giving him stink eye or talking about him bad to somebody else, right?
Yeah, you don't have the whole context of the situation.
That's right. And when we find somebody else who was there at the same time and we have a conversation with them about it, then they said, oh, but don't you remember? We were talking junk about that guy. And, you know, like, he had a good reason to be so upset, you know. And you start to unpack more of the truth of what actually happened. So fortunately in my journey, and I think this is a potential path for anyone who's had any past life memories, is that I began to have spontaneous recalls with people around me in my life. And as I began to have these recalls with other people, I also began to develop the courage to talk to them about it, to approach them about it, to notice and be able to tell energetically when someone just had a memory, because I could see it happen. And then I would just very gently ask them questions about, you know, did you see something? Was there something weird? And they'd be like, well, I know this sounds really weird, but I just saw dude man over there and he looked like a Viking. And I swear it was just weird. I don't know. That's how it would start. But, you know, what I worked on is developing tools and capacities to help people unpack those memories a little bit, to start to unfold what's there. The same way you would go back to that time on the playground and you'd think about, well, what happened before that and what happened after that? And where did you eat lunch? You know, and when you went home, what did your home look like? And what kind of stuff were you into at that age? What were some of your deepest challenges? Like, and start to really unfold the memory from this like one little glimpse to more of the context and the story and that kind of thing. Over the years, as I met more and more people and had these past life recalls with them, I began to have the groundwork to assemble the true stories about entire flows of events over whole lifetimes in some mm-hmm. cases. And when I say whole lifetimes, you know, I'm exaggerating slightly. There are certainly periods of my childhood and almost every life I can't remember. I don't remember being 2 years old. I don't, you know, there's a lot of things that I don't, and there's a lot of things that aren't very relevant, but there is a lot that is. Mm-hmm. And the things that I found became most relevant were not the big epic events. It wasn't winning a battle. It wasn't having some powerful ceremony happen or some coronation or whatever. Those were not the things that mattered the most. What mattered the most was having that experience of reunion with your father that you never really got to know in that other lifetime.
Right.
What really mattered was the experience of loss of a loved one when you were young, you know, or of suddenly meeting a woman again who you'd born a child with. Mm. And you know you're not going to bear a child with them in this life. They're with somebody else. You know, it's this crossing. Sure. But the love and the truth of the love that's there between you, you still feel it. You know it. It's undeniable. The experience of meeting your mother from another time and looking in her eyes, and she's younger than you in this life, but you look in her eyes and the wisdom that pours out and the graciousness that pours out just allows you to accept yourself so much more.
Gosh, how beautiful. Well, that's what really sets the human race apart from many other species is our emotional bodies, our depths of our emotion, you know, isn't it?
Certainly rich.
Yeah, I mean, I know it can be a cross to bear, but it's also just an incredible gift once we learn how to tailor it a little bit.
Yeah, indeed. But,
wow. So basically, I know that you had said in your other interview regarding you got together with your, you call them your soul family, mm-hmm. and you all started comparing stories.
Yeah.
And then basically that kind of went into this whole thing like, oh my gosh, we have something here.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't so much comparing stories as dealing with the echoes of previous times coming into this time and having to face similar experiences and having spontaneous memories and events occur with those experiences that then I felt the need to document and to record that in whatever way. Sometimes just in my own databanks up here until I had time to write it down or, you know, put it aside. And some of the experiences that we've gone through are so fantastic and so crazy that, you know, no one would believe you if you told them. And in fact, some of my friends who I've had some of the most powerful recall experiences with, for example, you know, there was one night where six of us all had recall experiences with each other and we all had different relationships and there were multiple timelines going on.
Wow. And
for example, a mother that I was referring to previously, I also remembered as my sister in lifetime, you know, many lifetimes before that. And, you know, two of the individuals in that circle, one of them was my father in two lifetimes, and one of them was my mother in one, and in another was a spirit guide who was helping me incarnate in another life. And, you know, the puzzle pieces were just incredibly beautiful, and the way that we had the remembering experience was so profound and so intense that anyone afterwards would just sit and go like, was that all a hallucination? Did that really happen? Is all that real? Like, people have difficulty grounding that kind of information. You know, and especially when you're remembering massive traumas too, like death and war and intense things that went down and your village being raided, you know, like your child being ripped away from you because it's not safe for the child to be with you, you know? And things like that, which are, they're very intense and it takes time it takes time to work through those emotions and through those experiences. And often, you know, many of us and in my family, I think, have had to do that alone, you know, deal with it through reflections of those times now, because it can be very challenging. And a lot of these things are, you know, a lot of the most traumatic, most intense experiences that many of us have had, we don't really want to look at it again. Right. And yet we've never really processed the grief around it.
Yes. Yes.
And so we have some work to do if we're going to integrate the skills, the wisdom, the abilities, and the love and the consciousness that is our gift. It's our gift. It's who we are. Like, you know,
very much so. And you know what, Adam, it's inherent within the guardian way mm-hmm. to find ourselves in very, I'm going to even use the word catastrophic circumstances because of the fact that we tend to be the freedom fighters.
Yeah.
We tend to be going into the situations where we're carrying the banner for freedom and justice.
Yes,
and,
we do.
And therefore we carry a lot of memories from some pretty heavy duty circumstances that aren't so nice to, you know, I mean, as I say to people a lot of times, we're carrying a very heavy backpack that we are being called to release at this time.
Yeah.
And when the guardians in particular, I feel, when they do this release work, they're impacting the entire planet because of their own gifts and their own power and their own abilities.
Yeah.
Wanted to know what you thought about that.
Well, you know, I look back in time to the earliest memory that I have, and I talk about it in the interview with Alfred and some other spaces, but in this case, all I'm going to say is, you know, I remember having the consciousness of an angel and looking at the experiences in the material world and looking at the challenges and the karmas and the transformations and seeing this divine, beautiful plan, which involves some very, very, very intense manifestation and embodiment, and that there's this beautiful, incredible miracle that can happen from what we in these realms perceive as the darkest shadows or the deepest traumas. And I remember choosing to dive, to fall, to come down into these worlds of matter to be able to support and assist other beings in going through that work. And I need help sometimes too. I have needed help so often, and I need my other family of angels out there to remind me, you know, to remind me that this is all part of a perfect plan, because sometimes it's difficult to see it.
Sure.
But I can, and I have, and I know, especially looking at the way that the events have flowed, you know, across the galaxy into this planet through the lifetimes that we've had here and into the now and this great juncture that we face right now, it is so beautiful. It is part of this incredibly beautiful story that is so, it's more brilliant and more well-written than I think any story ever could be that we could ever imagine or conceive of.
And could we even find the right vernacular to even describe it to the beauty that it is, you know? The
other certainly thing, not in English.
Yeah. The other thing you were mentioning was doing this alone. And that is another guardian trait. As I've said, we've been beaten and bludgeoned and burned at the stake and drawn and quartered. And, you know, we've gone into some very intense lifetimes and missions. And we seem to have a layover of drop and scatter to survive. Mm. You know, it's kind of like that whole thing of, okay, you know, I've seen this so many times in my own guidance. You're meeting and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning and it's a secret meeting and you know that you're all being hunted and you make an oath and you make a pact. I will meet you again in the next lifetime. And you scatter because, you know, if you're found together, you're really going to be screwed, you know? So, yeah. I mean, what you're saying is very applicable because we tend to really feel like, you know what, I can do this because we're so used to being solitary. We're so used to being kind of like a strong pillar, right?
Yeah.
That's holding the space.
It's a Jed.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, with that said, now that you've started the Academy and obviously you're communicating directly with the Guardian Alliance, no question about that in my mind, along with several other amazing beings, they talk a lot about the specific races that make up the Guardian Alliance itself. And I know that there's just a gazillion different types of races that take part in this. What is your feeling about that?
Yeah, in exploration of race and culture within the galactic family, a lot of my initial research was focused on understanding who we are as humans and really getting the groundwork for where most of the humans here have come from. Because, wow. You know, we've got to bridge with people. And the best way to bridge with people is for them to be able to gain a deeper understanding of who they are and where they're from. And so I explored with the ambassadors out there. I asked them to, you know, to show me and bring me initiations with the different species that have helped to initiate humanity. And so I went through several very powerful experiences in which I got a chance to have these initiation ceremonies done with me, and got to, through that, very, very clearly witness the deepest spiritual gift of a series of different star families. Mm-hmm. And these star families, and there were six of them, have had the most responsibility in terms of seeding humanity and also watching over and caretaking humanity over the ages. And this is, of course, in their words. This is just, that's, you know.
Sure.
And as I've done my exploration with people in the world that I've encountered, and students and people, clients and things like that, I have come to know that this is extremely accurate, because every single person I've ever worked with, almost, with the exception of probably maybe five or six, has had some deep connection, memory, or like they had been one of these other species.
Interesting.
And just these six in particular.
Okay.
And now I've encountered others who, there on very rare occasions, who don't fit into any of those six archetype lines or those six genetic lines, and they're, you know, they're wildcats and they came in here from other systems and, you know, are, have a lot, usually have a lot more difficulty being human.
Yes.
Because they came from a genome and a world and a culture that's so different that being here is really, really weird. I mean, it's hard enough being one of these six species, or a combination of them, which is usually the case because we've traveled between the different species, and so many Pleiadians and Syrians have had offspring, and Arcturians and,
yeah,
Syrians. And there's, you know, it's a very diverse galaxy out there.
Big time.
And, but, you know, it's hard enough coming from one of these six species and literally coming from what we on Earth perceive as like the super advanced future of Earth, and going back in time, so to speak, by, you know, literally coming to a planet that's super primitive, you know, and it was, you know, it was getting pretty advanced back in the age of Atlantis, in the end of the Lemurian period, and the time of Mu. And it looked like, you know, we were going to make the jump to becoming a galactic species, but it just wasn't able to happen at that time due to Earth changes and a variety of things. So those six species, I talk about on my personal sites, and if we collaborate to create a new galactic connection site together, I'd love to share some material about them there as well.
Yes, I already see that happening. Well, can you I know that you had sent me an email regarding this as well.
Yeah.
Can you at least list off those core six?
Sure.
That would be my first question. And I also want to find out what you think about how the Athians fit into this.
Sure. Yeah. So to list the six, the first three, most people will be very familiar with. And we've even named them based on our names of their star systems. So there's the Sirians, which are the most humanoid race in the Sirian race is very elven. They have, you know, pointy ears. They are very Nordic looking. There's a couple different races of elves. There's the kind of wilder elves and there's the high star elves. And much of Tolkien's translations that he brought through around the elves in The Lord of the Rings are actually stories of this people from the land of Eternal Sun, the dual sun system, the Sirian system. And that was a lot of my earliest kind of galactic research, was studying Tolkien's work and seeing how he was actually channeling the language and the culture of an actual species somewhere. You know, it took me a long time to figure out where or what. But I came from the Sirian system, so that made it a little bit easier as my most recent galactic family.
Yeah, I was going to say, as your most recent.
Exactly. And then there's Pleiadians, who, you know, come from the most humanoid Pleiadian species. Their planet is almost completely covered by water at this point, kind of a water world scenario that their planetary system went through, but over a long period of time. So it was very gradual, and most of that planet is covered with island chains where there's training grounds. And that very humanoid species has bluish white skin. They look very much like us. And their most significant feature, I find, is usually their eyes. And when you meet a Pleiadian who's come here from the Pleiades or who has a lot of lifetimes there, you immediately can tell they have these big eyes that are super deep and show their emotions so presently. And they often also have a lot of connection with dolphins and whales. Mm-hmm. They love cetaceans. They love the ocean. They can't get it out of their system. In fact, you know, if they don't spend enough time by bodies of water or large bodies of water, they start to have challenges because they need that connection with the sea and with the wisdom of the ocean. The Arcturians also are very well known. Although I feel that the Arcturians are also one of the great, most misunderstood species of this set, because a lot of the teachings of the Arcturians that have come through on this planet are the purely spiritual, highest level consciousness, pure thread of, you know, this is what you need to know about the universe and the divine. Mm-hmm. And not so much about who the Arcturians are and their culture and their dynamics. The Arcturians are genetic masters. They've developed, you know, genetic work for, you know, thousands and thousands of years, thousands of millennia, probably, you know, back to the earliest developments with their work. And so the original Arcturian humanoid species, while we would look at them and their culture very similar to like the dwarves in The Lord of the Rings, building massive caverns and structures and pyramids and creating these things, maybe not always being short and stout with heavy beards and furry feet, but having this solidity, like build it, record the ancestry in the earth, you know, honor your ancestors. A lot of the Native American, the red peoples on this planet, their teachings and their approach to life was a very ancient sort of Arcturian way of living. But over the millennia, with all of the genetic work, Arcturians began to change and transform into any kind of being that you can imagine. There are physical Arcturian beings that look like pretty much anything. And so this is also why when you look at other channels and records, you know, of the Arcturians, they look different almost every time somebody draws them. And all these people are going like, I don't think they're right. This is the Arc, you know, I don't think they're right. Arcturians are these guys, you know, or they're this ninth dimensional. Well, it's because they're geneticists and because they've taken on all of these forms, and they're very, very, very diverse.
Interesting.
And a lot of their wisdom is also a lot of the wisdom in the old Egyptian teachings about going deep into the shadow and into the darkness and facing the darkest places, and from there revealing the light.
Adam, if somebody's really got an affinity with Egyptology and Egyptian past lives, is it very much a likelihood that they're coming from that Arcturian species and race?
It's possible. I didn't spend much time as an Arcturian in galactic time, but I do have very, very strong connections with Egypt. And Egypt is, I would say, probably since Atlantis, it was the first reunion place for star families to begin coming together, building the sacred temples and doing the initiation work and the sacred work on the planet to help us get, you know, get through to the next level. And a lot of the oldest structures in Egypt were already built. They were part of the Atlantean civilization and matrix. And, you know, in the generations after that, we did the best we could to recover that wisdom and that knowledge. But of course, you know, faced intense issues and persecution, military industrial takeovers and things like that. And I tell some of the stories in some of my other interviews around Egypt. And I hope to share more of this library, you know, for people in a book at some point.
Well, you know what? Until that time, we're going to just go through some of this stuff.
Fantastic.
I'm excited. I've been asking.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. I've been asking. I've been percolating in the background waiting for this moment.
Yeah.
So I've been waiting for you, Adam.
Thank you.
What would be the fourth one? The fourth race.
So the fourth I'll talk of would be the Yahonians. The Yahonians come from a jungle planet that I think the best reference that people probably have in the collective consciousness for a planet is Dagobah, the planet where Yoda is from in Star Wars. Very, very dank, dense jungle, marshes, wet, very cloudy, foggy all the time. And the Yahonians that I've encountered, most of them look like they're Nigerian, like very, very deep, deep, dark black skin. And often with, you know, different symbols burned in or imprinted on their bodies in places. And the wisdom and the medicine of the Arcturians is plant medicine and the knowledge of how all different kinds of life have different flows of archetypal consciousness. Mm. And if you mix them together right, you can craft anything. Anything can come from life.
Yeah.
And the Yahonian story, you know, is that they used to go and sit inside of trees to meditate. And at some point, they learned how to use the tree as an external astral vehicle and actually travel through space with the tree helping them anchor their field and go, and they found starships. They found other species. And because a lot of the other galactic family had already developed the ability to like pick up a spirit when it's there, you know, or an astral being, and with augmentation technologies, you know, their computing systems and stuff can holographically render more visibly certain entities and beings that are inside their ships and spaces. And so when these Yahonians showed up, they're like, hey, how's it going? And the other galactic species are like, we're great. How are you? Where are you from? Where did you come from? Wow. And so they began to get to know each other. And over time, you know, eventually the Yahonians invited them to come and land. Mm. And so different species came and landed and they exchanged gifts and technologies, and a lot of the galactic family began to onboard the Yahonians to actual physical starships. And, you know, here you guys go. If you want to use these, you can. You don't have to, you know. There's a lot of deep medicines on this planet from the Yahonian species. And I would say those include Iboga, ayahuasca in particular is very, very strongly Yahonian medicine. And a lot of the Amazonian traditions and wisdom, because the Amazon is so much like this other planet, it was the ideal place for them to make contact with people here on Earth and support them in carrying these tools to this planet.
Does this fit at all with the Tree of Life, other than what we've normally heard about it?
Interesting. That's something I haven't really considered. What do you mean by the tree of life? Because there's a few different meanings for that. Do you mean?
There's actually quite a few, but I mean, if you look at all the ancient scripts and things that are making reference to the tree of life, I've never really associated it with an actual race that's within the trunk of a tree. Meditating and actually becoming one with the tree and receiving the energy of the tree, which I had a hermetic teacher that said to me, you know, the trees, they put out what's called yods, which is the force of life.
Yeah.
You know, and we talk about how the tree is the lungs of the planet. Well, it's, I don't know. I just kind of got that hit like, wow, this could have something to do with some of the older mythology and stories about the tree of life.
Indeed. Yeah. And also, interestingly enough, you could consider that the person meditating in this tree was probably taking the serpent medicine, which is the ayahuasca.
Right.
Snake mother medicine, which then helps them awaken their inner snake, their kundalini, and open up the central channels so that they can project their consciousness.
Sure. Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
that's cool. Okay.
Okay. So next, this one will be a favorite among this crowd here. The Chihaly. Yeah. Chihaly were a species that developed very basic interplanetary travel technology. They basically had a technological level akin to Star Wars, but without so much light speed abilities. And they developed their culture mostly on this very Earth-like planet and expanded to this desert planet, because the desert planet had these incredible crystalline mountains. And underneath these mountain ranges, these white mountain ranges, there were massive crystalline caverns, and life grew underneath the ground in these massive water-filled caverns. And so they began to build cities in these mountain ranges around these very, very desolate, plasma-like, playa-like desert grounds. And the Chihaly, a lot of their culture has always been based on physicality, movement, martial arts, expression, warriorship through dance, through performance, through creating, playing with fire and dancing with fire, and developed these traditions quite extensively. And then at a certain stage, the Chihaly planets were raided by a fleet of reptilian ships, which came in, and they were the first planets to get hit by the reptilians when the reptilians decided to expand their empire beyond the planets that they had already pretty much destroyed in their own star system. So their first jump was into this star system with the Chihaly, and they arrived, they came in, and pretty much decimated the Earth-like planet over a generation or so. And this was my first humanoid lifetime in this galaxy. And it's a long story, so I'm not going to tell it all to the listeners, but I'll share with you just a little bit about the Chihaly. But go ahead.
No, I just remember you shared an amazing story about landing, being... Your friend actually put a call out through a vortex of blue healing light, right?
Yeah.
And they ended up hailing you to this planet and assisting you and kind of coming to your rescue, so to speak. And I mean, I heard that. I got so activated. I started getting downloads I heard that.
Yeah, you're probably either on the ship with us getting rescued, or you're on the ship rescuing us.
It felt very familiar. It was mind-blowing. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so I get into full depth about the Chihaly and that series of events, which to me, very interestingly, resemble a lot of the series of events that happened in the Star Wars films. And my interview with Alfred Weber is about my kind of cross-referencing and looking at the actual events remembered by this group of star family and friends that I have, and my research into that, alongside looking at things like Star Wars and a few other stories that seem to be just fantastically popular and recognizable to our modern consciousness, and yet are very far out ideas, but they're so familiar to everyone, and everybody just completely loves them. They want to be in the story. They want to be in there. And it's my assessment that a lot of the reason for that is because these stories reflect real events, and a lot of these beings were there, you know?
Totally agree. Totally agree. So, okay, so yeah, that's number five. How about number six?
Yeah, Shihaly, the guardians, the martial artists, and the founders of the Jedi Order in the galaxy as well. And finally, the sixth is the Laquinanwininanwine, which I generally just say the Laquinan for short.
And it Laquinan?
Yeah, it's actually said as a song. So it's like, yeah. Laquinanwininanwine.
Ah.
And the Laquinan are like elders, they're guides, they're archetype weavers. And the story of the Laquinan is that they developed, they grew up as a species, they had their planet, they excelled, they became interstellar, they became intergalactic, they developed and developed and developed, and then it came time where their sun had aged so much that it was going to go supernova. And so when the sun basically went supernova, it completely destroyed their planet, and yet they kept the astral body of the planet intact using their spiritual technology. And they made that astral body of the planet a record-keeping device, a way to store data from all over the galaxy, and using the literal astral fabric of the galaxy itself to forge this sort of Akashic library.
Interesting.
And this Akashic library is located, for those of you who do astral travel and like to go explore other worlds. By the way, if you want to learn that, you can come to the Guardian Alliance. We're going to be doing more courses on that coming up this year. But you can go and explore this place. The star system that exploded is Cassiopeia A. And if you go to Cassiopeia A, which is a giant supernova, you'll find in its field, you'll find this very, very, very powerful beacon. And Cassiopeia A is one of the loudest radio signals in the sky. It's obviously massively broadcasting. And we have other supernovas up there, but that one is
really predominant.
A very strong broadcaster.
You know, I was going to say, Adam, the La Kuan Yin, I hope I'm saying it correctly, sure sounds an awful lot like Kuan Yin.
Yeah. Well, that would be appropriate. I mean, the La Kuan Yin, as archetype weavers, they explored over generations and generations what it was like to be physical and non-physical and play with mixing and matching different timelines and different archetypes together to see how it causes consciousness to unfold.
Interesting.
So they've helped guide a lot of the process on Earth and on other planets around, you know, how do you interface the Bushmen in Africa with the modern guys coming from New York City?
Mm.
You know, like, and what happens to their consciousness when those two archetypal threads mix? And in on our planet on Earth, we're in a period where we're having to go through so many archetype mixes. It's a modgepodge of yes. New consciousness that's never been before. And
especially so, this planet, you know, that's the purpose of this planet.
So Laquinan ambassadors usually are here because they can see that diversity, and they can also see how all that diversity somehow fits together. And so they're usually powerful networkers and mavens and connectors.
Ah, interesting. Could that be me? I wonder. A connector. So how do the Lyrans fit into this?
Well, you know, the Lyrans, as far as my research has gone with them, have, I think, played a very strong supporting role in conjunction with the Syrians.
Okay.
And basically been a supporting star family. The main Lyran race that I've encountered is a cat-like species, and you know, they fly around the galaxy, they do support work, they come here, they, you know, obviously our relationship with cats on this planet is something that's still developing in some ways. And in other ways, you know, lots of people have cats, and we have this really special, deep and often telepathic relationship with the cats. And that to me reflects some of what the teaching is that the Lyrans try to bring, which is about getting into this deeper level of telepathy and knowing with the beings around you, so that you're not trying to rely so much on what the person looks like or the expressions they might use or the way they use their language. Like, can you see someone for who they really are? Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of the lesson that I see that tribe is bringing. But I have a lot more work to do with the Lyrans, because I've only really strongly encountered, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6, 7 people that have really strong Lyran ancestry. And it's usually mixed with one of these other star nations as well.
Sure, sure. So the core 6 are always involved, ultimately.
Usually, okay. Yes. Many cases.
Well, now, have you studied at all any of Anna Hayes' material about the Magi Grail bloodline that's been incorporated into the Guardian races?
Actually, I have not. And I'll explain why, by saying that I have very, very purposefully not picked up or studied almost any of the other channeled material out there by different teachers, specifically in regards to galactic species and galactic families and their work, as well as the connections with them on the Earth. Because I have been doing my research and developing the groundwork that I need in order to know for sure from first principles, not from association. In other words, like if I already had the library that, Amor Renee or like, Barbara Marciniak or someone like that had already developed, and I had all of their writings in my consciousness, and then I was studying people's memories, I'd be very likely to be like, oh yeah, well that fits up with what she said. Oh, that fits up with what she said. And I would be just putting it in the box of what she said and trying to verify what she said by their experiences. Mm-hmm. But by doing it without that, I've had to say, that could be true. Maybe it's true. Let's see if that's true for other people. And then find other people. And until I have, you know, a circle of usually at least 4 to 5 people that remember the same thing. I mean, 3 is really the first key. 4, you get the pretty good confirmation. Once you got 5, it's pretty solid. It's very likely, especially when those 5 people don't even know each other. At that point, you've got some serious data. And so what I would love to know more about that, and also to discuss and cross-reference with you. And of course, I know that now in my life, it's probably time I should probably go study all these beautiful, amazing people's work so that I can speak about it.
No, but you know, that's what's great about talking to you is you're just purely coming from your own testimony, your own experience, your own research, your own, I'm going to use the word judgments, you know, observations, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's really great. It's refreshing. But it's also, it'll dovetail into some of the other information that I've at least read, you know, right. it's a good thing. But, so tell me a little bit about, do you feel that you associate with the Guardian Alliance, or do you feel that you're just kind of your own Guardian Alliance team doing this type of transpersonal work and accumulating data and research?
That's a great question. In my memory, because I remember moments when a Galactic Guardian Council was formed in the galaxy, and I played a significant role in the development of that Galactic Guardianship Council and the training and development of this Jedi collective. And when I say Jedi, I use that term because Jedi comes from the Jed, which is the pillar of the universe, which is the connection of all worlds, and really represents that which holds together all that is and returns it to the truth. So it's about support and stakeholding and space holding and supporting every person to have their own sovereign destiny. That's truly what a guardian is and what a guardian does. And I've been doing that since I was Shehaley and the Orion Wars were going on. And I've been doing that. I didn't have to do it so much for lifetimes after that as a Pleiadian and as a Sirian. There just wasn't that much intense stuff going down.
Well, lucky for you, huh?
Lucky for me. And then maybe, maybe I got bored. I was like, oh, well, Earth looks like a right place for, you know, getting back in the game. And sure enough, coming down here, you know, it wasn't actually that challenging. And I didn't even need that much guardianship work during the Age of Atlantis. But since the end of the Ice Age and the, you know, the spreading out of our peoples, and the journey of lifetimes after that through Egypt and Avalon and all the way into the present moment, there have been time after time after time where that work has been called to the forefront for nearly my entire lifetime. And so again and again, I have forged these circles of guardians and helped people to remember, and they've helped me to remember, and we've held this space with each other to do whatever we can to support humanity's greatest evolution and awakening, and with the hope of eventually reuniting this beautiful species and all of our souls with the rest of our star family that are all cheering us on. Because, you know, we made agreements to not get involved to an extent because you can't take away that sovereignty.
Right, right.
Humanity has to do it themselves. And since we're here and since we were born as humans, you know, we have to do it ourselves. And they're going to support us as much as they can. So to answer your question, if it's not already self-evident, is I don't look at myself as a lone warrior leading my own little band of guardians on this remote planet Earth.
Little band of guardians. I love that.
Yeah, I experience it much more as I'm a steward for this greater galactic work to occur here on this planet because we need that template. Yes. Here, we need that understanding of what guardianship is and that angelic presence of support and protection. And so I'm in service to that. That's what I'm.
No, and I'm glad to hear that because I got very much the same message. And I do feel that the guardian is automatically holding an immense space of stabilization on this planet. And therefore it's very important. It's like crucial, I should say, that all of the guardians do their inner work. And I mean now, and I'm talking mental and emotional bodies in particular, because they're spiritual bodies. Most of the time they're physical bodies. Well, some of the times are pretty dialed in, but this is part of what I'm going to say, kind of like the agenda, is if we're so locked up in all of our wounds, and as you say, past lives, you know, just these tremendous pieces of history that were very tumultuous. Yeah. The fact that we're kind of carrying that library of stuff with us. But we're missing the fact that that is one of our key roles, is to stabilize this planet through this transition. It's very important for us to be the very strong pillars for that.
And we each have to step up to that responsibility. Some of my brothers who I know were knights with me in the Avalonian age, I'll just call it. I've watched them grow. I know I've remembered with them. I've known they were there. They knew they were there. And I've also watched them run away from it and try to just stay immersed in their party world or stay immersed in, you know, just distracting themselves in this time from having to be called to such an intense role of leadership that they already embody. They are that.
Yes.
They are leading people when they're just like leading people by going and partying so hard that they're like, you know, on drugs for 3 or 4 days at a time and just like, you know, blissing out in Wonderland.
Yeah.
That's fine. It's okay. It's beautiful. We all should have that level of fun and ceremony and play, and we should all do that sometimes. But you also must come back to the world of where the seeds are planted and where the crops must be harvested and where the castles must be built and where you must establish the sort of living ceremony of life, where you're creating something that's sustainable and lasting for people for the future. And it's a big responsibility. It's difficult for people.
Thank you for saying that, Adam, because I've said this in many of my other interviews. There's so much emphasis placed on the emotions and the courting around a particular word to the point where it has really messed up the community. And one of those words is leader.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. So I'm constantly saying to people, we don't have any leaders in this world. Okay. And people need that, especially the human race, let alone a lot of us. We all need someone who's going to guide us when we're not in a place of complete, you know, grounding and stability and clarity. We all need that occasionally. We get too hung up on the emotion behind it. This is the time that the call is being placed for the leaders to step forward.
That's right. And a critical piece of that process happening is understanding that the meaning of leadership that many of us have been given is not actually reflective of true leadership. So many people believe that a leader, or even, you know, films and TV and things like that, you see this leader, right? And he's going to be king. And what does he do? He's always the guy going out charging first. He's always like leading the army. He's like the strongest one, you know? He's the guy with the best sword skills. He's the guy with the most muscles, you know? And he's going to be like, he just does what he must do no matter what and doesn't listen to anybody else and somehow succeeds and wins. I'm sorry, that's not true.
It's not the way it works.
There are some writers and there are some filmmakers who know this, and I've tried to kind of correct the story. The truth is that great leadership happens when an individual really listens to everyone else, really understands the needs of a group of people, and lives those needs, lives those challenges, goes through what they're going through, and faces that shadow, faces what the shadow is that collective is facing, and maybe struggles with it for a long time. But through their own personal process of overcoming that shadow and overcoming that struggle, they begin to shine and they begin to step out, and they've listened, they know, they understand what the people need. And so as a leader, they begin offering the guidance, supporting others in taking those steps through those same shadows and coming into the light. And as that happens, it is a natural swelling process where one person is simply holding the key. That's all they're doing. They're standing there for what is right and for what is good and for what is the healing in this challenge and in this experience. And by being that pillar, the community can actually stand up around them.
Exactly.
It's like they're helping just hold the ceiling up so everybody else can get up. And once everybody else gets up, they're constantly passing that leadership.
Right.
That torch. Here, take this and help others with it.
Right.
Here, take this and go ride. Yeah. Bring them this food. Bring back what you need. Go find out what that tribe needs.
Yes.
Find out what their problems are. Find out what it is and see if you can figure out how to solve it, or come back and we will counsel around it and figure out how we can help these people.
That's it.
That is what leadership is.
Adam, that's beautiful. And that leads to the round table, which I've developed a council that I've brought together. I know you have a council. The round table approach is very much the gathering of the leaders. Okay. It's the gathering of the guardianship. And each one of them brings to that table their own asset or talent or passion or what have you, where all of those that sit at that table must be in alliance with the core values, which, you know, I looked at your academy stuff and it was just absolutely gorgeous. Mm. You know, the words of integrity and truth and honor and justice and freedom and sovereignty. These are all the things that will be the ingredients for the heaven on earth that we so desperately want to create and build and grow and be, you know, but it must be done from the positioning of understanding that you yourself have something very valuable. You've done this a gazillion times in many other lifetimes. I'm finding this. I have so many what I believe to be Knights Templars from other lifetimes that have come through the implant removal process. Mm. Okay. And yet when you speak to them on the phone, they don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. They feel it. They have the frustration. They have all these amazing talents within, you know, being very athletic, maybe very scientific, maybe very good with building or financing, but they haven't really connected those dots.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons, by the way, folks, that Adam and I are coming together, because it's very clear to me that we've been kind of prepped, Adam, almost, for this to take place.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Knights Templar.
Yeah.
And also I would like to talk about some discernment between the Knights Templar and what I call the Avalonian period.
Cool.
And kind of look at the difference, because I think a lot of times some of those threads get a little confused. And there are similarities, but there are definitely soul family similarities as well in both of those cases. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about that.
I would love, that's what I was segueing into, because okay. You brought up the table and the council and things like that. And so, you know, there is a definite connection between the Guardians and the Knights and the Knights Templar and even the Sisters of the Rose. And I'd love to just open it up with, what have you seen? What have you been finding in your research regarding that period of time?
Yeah, well, there's a huge period of the development of the Knights Templar that I wasn't a part of, and I wasn't in, but I do have soul family who were there during that time, and I've been able to, by my association with them and also my encounters with them in later times, and my experience with them in later times, sort of assess some of the core of what went down and what was going on. And I'll just very briefly, I can discuss it very briefly by saying that, you know, there have been again and again cycles where certain spiritual concepts have come under great duress on this planet. And oftentimes there have been awakenings occur and new technology developments occur and renaissances. And these renaissances often end by this a wave of karma and oppression and containment. And we've seen this occur over and over again, usually with different religions on this planet, where there's this concept of there's one way to get to the truth. There's one way to get to source. You know, you have to go under our rules. It's usually a control play or a power play or that kind of thing. And during the times when these renaissances occur, when it starts to shift, if it does shift that way, which it has some of the times on this planet, where there begins to be a very inquisitorial sort of oppression group that's coming in and trying to control the situation and control all the power that's now being shared with the people, there arises the call of the Guardians. And when the Guardians are called to this work, we know that what we must do is we must protect what is sacred. We must keep it sacred and keep it safe. And as you said, like hide and disperse, that's a classic, very classic Templar, you know, approach. And, you know, early on that kind of, that work with the Templars was a knighthood of keeping the sacred knowledge, of keeping the sacred wisdom of the Christhood, of the alchemy of Magdalene, of some of the Egyptian initiations, Solomon's seal, and a lot of the Hermetic traditions. There were aspects of the Library of Alexandria, like wisdom kept there, wisdom of Thoth, wisdom of these different traditions that I think a lot of the early Templars were really trying to hold and keep and bring to places where it could be safe, in secret libraries, kept with certain monks, and other individuals. And over time, as the persecution and the oppression of such ideas became more and more violent and more significant, especially the persecution of the Christian church at the time, it became clear that they couldn't be separate. They had to somehow integrate with the society and the culture of the time. And one of the best, and I think a very wise tool that they used to do this, was to leverage finances, to actually become a transaction keeper and build banks and actually create a way to actually always have the resources to build their castles, to build their temples, to protect these places, to build the secret places where they could keep sacred relics and artifacts, and yet have a face in the masses and not be some, you know, separate, hidden, secret sect that that was constantly under persecution.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Do you have any memories, or have you investigated the actual origin when the Knights Templar came about? Supposedly it was back in 1118, and there was originally 9 knights that created it. Do you have any memories of that?
You know, I don't, but it's an interesting date, because it's not very long after the period of time when we were doing our work in Avalon. And so I can speak to that because I think the same keys are there. And one of the processes that, you know, that time was about, it was a very spontaneous sort of convergence of soul family, I would say, in the Isles at that time. And really, the ones who got their shit together were the priestesses. The women came together, they began finding each other, they began establishing connections and orders and trainings, and they built this whole, you know, space. And this is why I call it the Avalonian Age, because it's in honor of them. It's in honor of this incredible academy that they built to train women and to bring together the wisdom and the magic and the leadership within the women that the world so desperately needed at that time. And during this time period, there were all different sectors of lords that were battling each other and coming at each other and trying to like land grab and somehow like be the guy who's going to like control most of the land. And also you have Vikings, barbarian like dudes coming in, and they just want to come in, rape some women, take what they want, take their resources and go home. Mm-hmm. Like it was fun for them to like come into these islands and, you know, take of its wealth and go home and be champions, you know, and it was part of their culture. And so you have these horrible raids occurring. At the same time, you've got all of these divided factions in, and everybody's disagreeing, and all these men are testosterone is so strong, you know, and they're just like, you know, take what you want, you know. And into this space, you know, there comes this vision of change and this potential for change. And the potential for change is that, well, if somehow this whole land could be united, it would be so wealthy. It would be so healthy. It would be amazing. And we could hold off the barbarian attacks. We could protect the people. We could live off this wealthy bounty of land, and the land would be healthy and healed. And I think the wisdom came from the women, and also from, you know, certain individuals who came in and offered guidance at different times. And there were astrological signs coming in showing that this was going to happen. And what I know from communication with my family that remember these events, there was particular junctures that were happening in which they knew they had to reinvoke the spirit of the dragon to help awaken the land. And so with these astrological conjunctions occurring, there were great magics cast to invoke the dragon and to bring this wisdom into the land. And this coincided with a specific sort of series of experiences where they were looking for who was the person that was going to be able to do this. And so they applied their magic to the gift of a certain individual and another individual, both of who I know personally in this time, to come together, even though it was nearly impossible conditions for them to come together. She was the wife of another man, and he was a wild partier traveling the lands, you know, who was madly respected because he was very strong and very powerful and very, you know, heart forward and just courageous about anything. And doesn't even matter if he was the most skillful, he was just very, very courageous. And the bringing together of these two individuals birthed a child, and this child they designated as some special child that may have the capacity to lead. It was a soul calling that went on and occurred. And without getting into too much detail, which I probably shouldn't for the sake of our audience, although they may really want to know, but I will instead just kind of briefly cover the unfoldings of what happened. The child was protected for its youth, in order to not, you know, be interfered with, because if any of these men knew that these high priestesses had like planned to have this individual be the king at some point, you know, it would have been bad. But over time, the events that occurred sort of dissembled that whole process. In other words, the child was lost. There were many events that went down and changes going on and changes going on with the Council of Women that really challenged this as a potential future. And what it came down to was a specific juncture where this individual was in a battle and was wounded very, very intensely and almost died, or probably would have died, except that where he hid in order to get away from the battle, he was found by one of these priestesses. And this priestess came to him and tended his wounds and realized that he was probably still going to die if she didn't bring him back to this group. And also, some soul resonance occurred in which she knew she had to bring him back and help this person. And so what happened was the women taught him and helped him to awaken to his true self. And as that occurred, the calling got stronger and stronger that it was going to be time to go and find the other men that were going to help forge this circle of chalice and blade and bring together this ancient wisdom. Because again, it was all about this ancient wisdom of the dragon, the deepest alchemy, the secrets of the land, the truth of who we are, the truth of our connection with the stars and what we're here to do on the earth. And so, eventually the man and some of these women were capable of going and riding out and finding the knights, finding these individuals who were basically had the most presence in their fighting, the most total clarity. Many of them didn't even want to be in battles. They just happened to be there and having to like be in service to something, you know, and they're really good at it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, one at a time. And often these men were not, so many times they were not knights. They were young men. They were apprentices. They were farmer kids who just got a sword and then ended up fighting for some duke, you know, or whatever. And slowly but surely, this circle began to be gathered. And the women initiated these men over and over again into deeper levels of magic and consciousness. And they helped them to remember who they are. And the circle began to be forged. And this is how the table was made. And a lot of these stories, you know, I don't think you'll find anywhere. But I think there are probably some people that do a better job than most. Friends of mine who were there with me and had their own experiences or were parts of this circle, they often refer to Marianne Zimmer Bradley's work and The Mists of Avalon as probably one of the most accurate stories. And I imagine that that is probably true. I watched the TV show of it or the video on movie at one point.
I cried through the whole thing. I'm not kidding, Adam. I cried through the whole movie.
Yeah. And you know, there's keys there.
A big time.
While they, you know, they totally missed certain facets, and I don't know if she missed them in the book or just in the movie or whatever, it's fine. I mean, it was a complex series of events to somehow recall, record, and lay it all out. It would be an immense task, even for someone who was in the middle of all of it. It would be extremely difficult. And, you know, it's not that important to know all the details of what happened. But what is important to know is that there were also a lot of traumas and karmas that came up for people in that time. There were traumas and karmas among the women where they lied to this circle of men and women at different times, and where certain things were kept secret, where, you know, a brother and sister were brought together and to bear a child without knowing that they were brother and sister.
Right.
And when you find out you have a child with your sister, you can imagine the kind of rage and the intensity that someone might go through and the betrayal that someone might feel and the layers of issue and challenges. And there were many, and not to mention the barbarian attacks, not to mention the difficulty of forging a healthy, amazing land, you know, and recovering and bringing all of the forces of the land together. But the key was the Grail. And the understanding of the Grail is the key that I think was truly passed down through the ages and carried by the Knights Templar as well, though many of the concepts around the Grail, I think, were distorted eventually because they had to work with the Christian oppression forces that were going on, just as we did in Avalon. They were beginning to arise. I mean, it was like the dragon or the cross, you know, and it's like, here's the dragon, they're the evil, they're the demons, that's the devil. Here's the cross, it's the good, it's the light, it's the whatever. And it's total, you know, BS. And the fact was, is that we had to also work in the end of that time to build alliances by adapting and accepting the Christians, accepting this new way and somehow trying to integrate with it and work with it with the old ways. But the Grail was never a cup to catch the blood of a man on a cross.
Right.
The Grail was the divine feminine. The Grail is the symbol of that container which can hold space for anything, that which can hold the waters of life. The Grail is the gift of eternal love. It is the gift of divine love. And if you can but sip of the Grail of divine love, your soul will remember who you are, and you will live forever because you will remember who you are. Mm-hmm. It is not eternal life in the flesh. Mm-hmm. It is eternal life by memory of the soul and the spirit.
Right.
And it is such a gift. It's a gift that everyone, I think, has an opportunity to receive if they really ask for it, if they really want it in themselves. And this is something that's a little different. And my father has taught me a lot about this in this lifetime because of his wife, Carolyn, who passed away in that car accident. And, you know, it's the yang and the yin, you know, exist all the way up to that bridge to the infinite eternal source. And in that first division of source, the very first breath, the first consciousness that is, there is yang and yin. And in that first breath of the divine, there is also the Trinity. There is the will of God and the mind of God. And then the love of God is this field that connects them both. Yes. It bridges them. It bridges the mind, the body. It bridges all things. And because it is the grace, it is the divine feminine, you can't just make grace happen.
No.
You can't go at it with yang. You can't go attain grace.
Yes.
No. You can't attain divine love. Divine love is something that you must ask for inside.
Yes.
You must open yourself to receive it. You have to accept the divine feminine inside of you and forgive yourself, love yourself, heal yourself, and ask for that healing to happen inside of you. And when you open up your soul and your being to receiving that grace and that divine love, it flows. And when it flows, it changes everything. And there were seekers of the Grail in that time. And I know one of the Grail Knights. And I will tell you his name, although I haven't spoken any other names during this whole time, because it's very important for me to let people know that when you remember who you are, what's most important is that you know who you are. Mm-hmm. And not what you tell others who you are. Mm-hmm. You must be who you are. You can't tell people who you are, because if you're just serving to tell people who you are and it's just serving your ego, it's right. not serving them.
Totally.
Right. Totally. And so, but this individual I will honor because this individual's name is Richard Rudd in this lifetime.
Okay.
And he's a Grail Knight and he knows it. And he brought through a very, very, very special work in this lifetime. This work is called the Gene Keys.
Mm.
And if I give no other gifts to this audience that is listening to us here today, giving them the gift of exploring the Gene Keys is more than enough.
Fantastic.
It is amazing.
Fantastic, Adam. And I would have to say that as we continue to talk in the future, I can guarantee you I have more of those nights coming forth.
Wonderful.
Because I know who I am. I'm pretty sure who I am. Wow. I'm sitting here just processing everything you said. Now, have you gotten a glimpse of the true triad relationship between Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere?
Yes. Yes, I've had some trials with that for sure. Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you know, love is a confusing thing. And I'll speak to it in a way that will help people relate to challenges in their own lives. Because, you know, you fall in love, you have deep and powerful connections with people. And also, sometimes, and there have been time periods where it just makes sense to be with someone who's your friend or someone who is right for the work to be done, you know? And in other ages, this was much more common. Nowadays, we're all like, oh my God, arranged marriage, you know, that kind of thing. It's great. Like, what the heck? That's insane. But there have been times on this planet where, you know, there were larger agendas at work. And in fact, you know, if you're really trying to, and at that time, boy, those women, let me tell you, a lot of them, I love them so much, but boy, they were really trying to manipulate events to make sure that we succeeded.
Yeah.
And in many of those cases, manipulating events to such an extent that it actually created more problems.
Sure.
And more challenges. And that's okay. That happens when you try to control everything. That's the
right, that's in a nutshell.
And, you know, for Arthur and Guinevere, coming together was absolutely the right choice for the people and for their families and for the good and welfare of the kingdom. But it wasn't a marriage of love. It wasn't based on them having passionate, falling in love with each other and whatever. And there were many, many layers that happened before that, where Arthur had many other lovers. And there are many women that he did have deep, deep, you know, lifetimes worth of love and connection with from other times, you know. And so you have to always take all of that into account. And so when Lancelot comes and, you know, Arthur finds him, they run into each other in battle, and, you know, he discovers this man who's like a complete wild being, but is one of the best fighters ever, like incredibly amazing, incredibly skillful. You know, he wanted to bring those skills in because it is valuable to have the skills. Like the leadership is good, but man, you know, if you find the best, you know, if you need fighters and you find the best swordsman you've ever met in your life, the greatest thing that you can do is bring that person to other people that need that person's skills.
Sure.
You know, and help them learn those skills. And so, you know, when Lancelot shows up, of course, here's this powerful past life love charge that unfolds between him and Guinevere. And, you know, I can say from my memory being present in this situation that, you know, it wasn't at all the love between Guinevere and Lancelot, and even Guinevere's infidelity with Lancelot or her making love with him and all of that. None of that was the cause of Arthur's distress at that time.
Okay? I agree.
That's not where his pain came from. Okay. I will tell you where his pain came from. It was from discovering that he was manipulated by some of the priestesses that he had dedicated his life to serving when he found out that he had born a child with his sister.
Right.
And that was kept from him.
Yes.
For many, many years.
Yes.
That is where the darkness and the pain and the hurt happened.
Right.
That destroyed for a while that table. And that divided the sword and the chalice. And that caused so much pain and hurt until the grail could be found again.
Right.
And the forgiveness could be given. And yet, even with all of that, in the end, he and his own son killed each other. In the end, it still was one of the most painful endings of a life you can imagine anyone going through. And
he didn't die quickly. Arthur did not die quickly either.
No.
He lingered.
And so, you know, when you look back at these kinds of things, you know, the distortion in the story is like related to the Christian principles that often got impressed onto the round table and the knights of the round table as the 12 apostles. And, you know, Arthur is this Jesus character and he's bringing the cross, you know, and it's like, that's such a bunch of BS, but like, It's cool. I mean, they can co-opt every other tradition, so why not that one, you know? And
but, Adam, not to interrupt, but I really want you to be aware of this. Ralph Ellis, have you seen his latest work?
No.
He is a master researcher out of England. Mm. Really cool guy, who, by the way, I would love to interview, so just pass that on to him.
Okay.
Anyway, he has been researching the BS of the timelines in which history had been released.
Yeah.
regarding Yeshua Mary story and the King Arthur Guinevere story. And through, I mean, I think he said he researched something like 7 Arthurian scripts. And he found that there was a 40-year period deliberately injected into the stories to make it look like they were at different time frames, when in actuality, he is convinced that they basically are one and the same.
Interesting.
Very, very interesting. I mean, you got to watch it. It's like a 3-part series. He's done a lot of work. And of course, again, it's based on that which has been written, which I think, I'm not quite sure the antiquity of the material that he's gone as far back to. But there is definitely a pattern involved, in he's looking at the key players such as Joseph of Arimathea and Mary Magdalene and, you know, and then King Arthur and Lancelot. And he said there were so many things that were revealed to him that just blew his mind.
Yeah. So very interesting.
What do you think about that as far as, you know, the reference of, like, for example, you just said, okay, Arthur being Jesus, it's a bunch of BS.
Yeah.
But is there, in fact, maybe some intertwining of those two stories being one and the same as far as maybe the core purpose of the story itself?
Well, if we step back and you look at things from an angelic perspective or a galactic perspective, especially if you're Laquinon, you'll notice that there are repeating patterns in the hero's journey, so to speak, and in stories of transmutation. And this planet has had to go through lots of transmutation. And so a lot of times the same kind of alchemical processes come in, similar cycles come in, and there are patterns where souls play out a similar geometry in order to awaken and enable a new period of grace and consciousness to occur on the planet, you know, to bring the new seeds of where the future is going to go. And of course, the people don't always carry those seeds properly, and sometimes they get massively distorted. I'll just say that from my perspective, it doesn't really matter if they're in the same time period or this is the same thing or not. My hunch is that there's plenty of historical data around the time period where Jesus traditionally was, and the kind of cultural and technological aspects of that time period were somewhat different from the early Middle Ages when the Arthurian period occurred. But you know, I apologize to, first of all, to any of all the Christians who may be listening to this, for being so harsh around Christianity, because in many ways, Christianity has also brought some of the most beautiful gifts of consciousness to this world. Unfortunately, it hasn't been represented that well over the ages, and there's been certain principles missing, like honoring people for who they are, not taking their culture away, you know, things like that. And, you know, when I say that there's, you know, this whole thing about Arthur and these knights and these the apostles and stuff like that, there are similarities there, and the similarities are archetypal. They're the archetypes of the energies that are being brought through. The one who is in service to the divine love and the sacred chalice more than anything else. And through the showing of that service, the others who come around him realizing that that path of service is the path to spiritual well-being and enlightenment. And there wasn't 12 knights. There was more than that, many more than that, at some periods of time. But you can also see probably some of the same pattern dynamics in the first knights, the first people who gathered with Arthur and like helped to forge that circle. I'm sure there's a lot of similarities.
There's definitely some incredible similarities to the way in which they had the core values.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you were not going to be part of that intimate group without being able to stand tall in those values.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. Because there was too much on the line in both time periods.
Right.
And, you know, I have a gazillion questions, and we're running out of time, believe it or not. But time flew by.
Indeed.
And so, you know, again, I'll just contact you to maybe let's go into part two, because I would love to dive a little bit more into Avalon from the standpoint, yes, it's not that important to be fixated on that time frame, but I have to say there's hundreds of thousands of people that are very catalyzed by that time period. And I feel that if we delve into it a little bit deeper, we're going to activate them.
Yes.
Even more so. And that's really the purpose to this, isn't it? I mean, it's really to help us all really get clarity on who we are. And you'll activate me too. There's a nice little benefit.
It's a gift.
It's a gift. So anyway, did you want to finish up with anything before we kind of tie this all up?
Well, let's see. Did we wrap up everything around that time period well enough for right now?
There's so much to discuss.
There is so much. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'll say one piece, which is that this contrast between the cross and the dragon, you know, and this Christian ideal and the dragon ideal, again, is something that we face right now. And it's a beautiful alchemy, because what the cross represents, the old cross, you know, the old cross represents, you know, the four directions. It represents the grid of building, of manifesting, of creation, and in many ways represents the yang. It represents the masculine force and field of consciousness, like directing its consciousness, as do many of the geometries as you go up.
I even think it represents space and time too.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
Yeah, space and time, absolutely. Like represented by those lines. But so, go ahead.
Yes, and space-time and literally gravity. I mean, based on my work in quantum gravity, what we know is that you have this equilibrium field and it has to go into curvature to create gravity, because gravity is the curvature of space-time itself. It also has to curve to create objects like atoms and molecules, protons, things like that. And the only way that an equilateral, like a lattice of energy in complete equilibrium, the only way that lattice could actually fit together and be in total balance in equilibrium would be if it was tetrahedral. And if meaning tetrahedral, it means also that on any plane or any surface of that fabric of space-time, it's hexagonal, right? But to have curvature, you can't have a hexagonal lattice go into curvature. It won't initiate. It won't start curving. And so how do you start curving it? Well, one of those points in that hexagonal lattice has to come out. And so when that point radiates out, when it travels through and spins through the field, the rest of the field curves to fill in that missing gap. And when that missing gap is filled, the shape you get is the pentacle. It's the five-pointed star. It's five equilateral triangles connected. And that symbol, the symbol of gravity itself, literally what we're coming to understand is the quantum gravitational action of gravity in physics right now, happens to be the very symbol that the Druids held, that were held in the Knights of Avalon, that is the symbol of literally the divine God in physical form, how physical matter manifests. You use this pentacle to influence the physical world.
Wow.
And so, yes, it is this act of creation, you know, which is created by releasing something and also focusing in. You know, you release, you let go of what you don't need, and you focus on what you do need, and matter begins to come into being. Yeah. And so in contrast to this, the dragon is like the flow of light and energy through that fabric. It's the emotional flow. It's the vibrational flow. It's Whereas the fabric is the masculine, the space-time structure is the masculine, the dragon is the current, it's the feminine, it's the moving consciousness. Beautiful. And one of the things that we need to restore now, again, just like in the Age of Avalon, is restore that divine feminine wisdom. We must call in the dragon, and that means calling in ourselves.
Yes.
Calling in who we really are as powerful beings that resonate through the fabric of space-time and actually drive the wheel of time, the serpent eating its own tail. We drive the wheel of time through our will and through our grace. And we must reclaim that level of capacity and consciousness inside of us, the emotional wisdom that the dragon can bring us.
Thank you. And I love the fact that you're incorporating will into that, because that's such a huge component right now that's missing.
Indeed.
The will is missing within so many of us because we've been beaten down. Mm. We're exhausted. Many of us are tired. You know, we've been at this for a long time. We've lost our way, so to speak. Yeah. So please do yourself a favor. Check out Adam Apollo's website. It's the Guardian Alliance, and it's guardianalliance.com, is it not?
Guardian.is is one entry. And also for the viewers who watch this video, we'll have a special link that we can put below there for your viewers.
Perfect.
That if they want to take courses, it'll be like a deep discount link so that they can get started easier and that kind
of thing. Well, there you go. See, I didn't even know that. So if you support Galactic Connection, you're going to get a discount going through there. There's a Benny. But you're going to fall in love with this course. I actually heard that this was going to happen with my own guidance. And there's just a lot. There's a lot of information up there. It's going to ring true to you. Things like, will you accept your mission in life? Can you allow yourself to be the hero? Are you willing to trust yourself? There's a biggie. Can you forgive yourself for doubting? There's another biggie. Will you choose to be yourself now? These are areas that we are really trying to put a fire under your feet to do, because we need you. You are who we are waiting for. We are who we are waiting for, right? It's truly true. So anyway, stay tuned for part two. I think Adam and I agree we're going to continue this journey. And I think, as you all know, you can feel more than free to send forth questions that I can ask Adam. I'm more than happy to compile questions like I used to do before with several of the other types of interviews I've had. Mm. And in the meantime, please do not forget, Galactic Connection is gratis. We run 365 days a year. We're providing you information and the pulse around the world through the galactic lens of what's going right on the planet. And we want to make sure that you all are realizing that Galactic Connection is your site as well as ours. Adam is here to assist us after we got so severely hacked last year and attacked by you know who. Adam is going to be assisting me in creating the new server. So thumbs up, right?
Let's do it.
I know, I can't wait. So anyway, love you guys. Please just check us out. We have the new phase four. It's called, get this, Adam, the Guardian Protection Initiation. And it rocks. It is really powerful. I'm getting goosebumps. So check that out. It's up on the right column of the website, and also the stepping out formula for the Guardians. That's really important. I'd like you to check that out as well. Lots of love. Stay tuned for next time. Love you guys, and we'll take care.
Aloha kea kua.
Aloha kea kua. Oh, I like that. Talk to you later. Bye.